Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Wednesday General Audience. Pope Benedict stresses the importance of the sacrament of confession and looks at the figure of the 12th century theologian William of Saint-Thierry during his catechesis. Sex slaves. As we mark today's International Day for the Elimination of Slavery, we shine the spotlight on a modern form of slavery, that of human trafficking, whose victims often end up being forced to work as prostitutes. And forgiveness and redemption. We talk to the founder of the Cherish Life Circle in New York City that reaches out to the families of murder victims and to the criminal on death row. Here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict spoke about the importance of the sacrament of confession and also continued his catechesis on leading theologians of the Middle Ages during his Wednesday General Audience. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
At the end of his General Audience Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI encouraged young people to escape sin and plan their future in generous service to God and neighbour.
San Giovanni Maria Vianney, San Pio da Pietrelcina.
In this way, the Pope then indicated some examples. Saint John Marie Vianney, patron of this year for priests, and Saint Pius of Pietrelcina, whom he described as extraordinary figures of apostles of the confessional.
Proprio oggi ricorre il 25esimo anniversario.
The Pope also drew attention to the 25th anniversary of the promulgation of the apostolic exhortation, Reconciliatio et Penitentia, a call to the importance of the sacrament of penance in the life of the Church. A sacrament he also recommended to newlyweds, inviting them to create a family of faith in a constant climate of mutual understanding, as well as priests and all Christians.
Dear brothers and sisters,
in his catechesis this Wednesday, Pope Benedict continued his lessons on those great theologians of the Middle Ages. This week, he spoke of William of Saint-Thierry, a close friend of Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, who said only love for God and neighbour gives meaning to our choices.
William took active part in the 12th century movement of monastic renewal, and after serving as abbot of Saint-Thierry, he entered the Cistercian monastery of Signy. A central theme of his writings is the nature and power of love, sin is the ultimate vocation and the driving force of the human spirit.
Pope Benedict said that for William, this innate human drive finds perfection in the love of the triune God, the source and goal of all love. As the culmination of a process of purification and integration of the affections, the love of God brings supreme human fulfillment and a profound experiential knowledge of both God and the world around us.
In William's celebrated phrase, amor ipse intellectus est, love itself brings knowledge. By contemplation of the mysteries of the faith, we grow in the image of God, and by uniting our will to his, we become one with him.
The Advent atmosphere permeated this week's audience as pilgrims and visitors to the square attempted to catch glimpses of the Vatican Nativity scene currently being built in the heart of St. Peter's Square.
E li ringrazio per il generoso dono dei panettoni.
Further underlining the coming festive season, at the end of the audience, the Italian Federation of Bakers and Confectioners presented Pope Benedict with a stock of panettone, the traditional Italian Christmas cake, to distribute to the poor this Christmas. I'm Emma McCarthy.
December the 2nd is the International Day for the Elimination of Slavery. And so today I'd like to take a closer look at a modern form of slavery, that of human trafficking. Its victims are usually women or minors, and very often they end up being forced to work as prostitutes. Here in Italy, the government passed a law in 2008 outlawing prostitution in public places. But sex work as a private business remains legal. Many of the women or girls plying the sex trade in Italy are foreigners, and experts in the field say the vast majority of them are the victims of human trafficking. Let's hear more in this special report. Outreach groups believe that Italy has over 50,000 prostitutes. But how often do we ever stop to think about the circumstances that led these women or girls to take up the world's oldest profession? Most of us may be inclined simply to see them as mere prostitutes, but nowadays a more apt description for the majority of them would be sex slaves. Italian sister Eugenio Bonetti has been named by the US State Department as one of the heroes acting to end modern-day slavery for her work in sheltering and rehabilitating women rescued from forced prostitution. According to Sister Eugenia, most of the women working as prostitutes in Italy are recruited back in their home countries and come here under the pretext of a job. Many are from Nigeria or Eastern Europe, especially Romania. After being tricked in this way, their documents are taken away and they are forced to sell their bodies for money. I sat down with Sister Eugenia and she told me more about the grim reality of working as a sex slave in modern-day Italy.
We no more speak about prostitution when we deal with these women, because we are very much aware that these women have not chosen to become prostitutes, but they have chosen to come to Europe, to Italy, in order to help their families to better their lives and the lives of the members of the families. Because the majority of the women we see on the streets are there because they are forced to be there. This is the difference between being a prostitute because you want to do that, or to be forced to be a prostitute because you have been sold and bought by criminal organization because they want money from these women.
Where do these women mostly come from, and what sort of age are they?
The two biggest groups that we are dealing with, they are Nigerians and Romanians nowadays. There is a difference between the Nigerians and Romanians. Romanians are very young. The majority nowadays we can meet on the streets that are Romanians are below the age of 18.
How young do they get?
They can be even 15, 16, 17 years. They are very young, though they don't say that they are minors. Instead, for the girls from Nigeria, the age is a bit higher. So you can have 19, 20, 21, 22. But there is a difference nowadays with Nigerian women. The ones we are receiving now, they are not educated. So they are coming really from the bush.
And so how are these women being tricked into coming? Is it a case of somebody coming along who's working for the traffickers, who tells them that he can get them a good job in a city or in the West? How does it happen?
Of course, now the recruitment is done normally in places of origin. And this is done either by women or relatives to the women who are the traffickers, or it is done by some men that offer some help when the girls have no option, no opportunities, because they simply say, now, we have a sister, we have a friend, we know somebody that is looking for somebody that can work in their restaurant, in their factories, in their shops, and so they need somebody to help them. Of course, they have no money, they have no documents, but they say, don't worry, we are going to take care of all these kind of things. You should not worry. Once you are in Italy, you will give us back the money we spent for you. So they present themselves as really people who would like to help.
And is that the same in Eastern Europe as well? Is it a similar sort of situation, or are there differences there?
Now, in Eastern Europe situation, it's very different, because in Eastern Europe we have young boys that lure these girls on a pretense of falling in love with them. The majority, they have a young boy that says, now we go to Europe, Now we get married, we work, and when they are in Europe, the girl goes to work on the street and the man eats all the money. For Nigerians, normally we have women exploiting women, which is terrible. The young girls from the East are controlled at the site on the street. Instead, for the Nigerian girls, they are not controlled by anybody because they are controlled by the voodoo. The black magic they have to perform before coming to Italy. And so there is no need for the madams to follow them and to know where they are and what they do. Because this psychological violence, this black magic is performing on these young girls, especially if they are uneducated, it is more than enough to control them and to make them believe that if they run away, if they report the case to the police, the bad spirit is going to hold on them, is going to destroy them, to destroy their families. And we have many, many cases of girls who are mentally sick because of this black magic.
Now, once these girls, by whatever means, they end up in the hands of the pimps in Italy, and they find themselves being tricked into working on the streets, how badly are they treated? Apart from the voodoo, do they sometimes use physical violence to force some of these girls, particularly the girls, say, from Eastern Europe?
For everybody, you know, life on the street is always a great risk, and you have to put into account really mistreatment, not only on the side of pimps or madams, but also on the side of clients, maniacs, so they are always at risk. But the majority that it's done by the pimps and the madams is when the girls are not going back home with money. Maybe sometimes they are not having enough money, so when they go back, they are beaten. They are beaten thoroughly in order to make them work more and to make sure that when they go back at the end of their night time or day time, they can bring 200, 300, 400 euro. Otherwise, they are really very, very much mistreated.
This money, do they have to hand it all over?
All the money, it has to be handed over to the traffickers or to the madame. This is the case in a special way nowadays for Nigerians. Until they have finished to pay their debt, a Nigerian, to be free again, she has to produce more than 70, 80,000 euro.
So how many of them do ever get free? Because that's a huge amount of money.
This is a huge amount of money that for a young girl that has to pay this money, she has to undergo not less than 4,000 sexual encounters. And when she has finished to pay this money, she's also finished in all aspects. Physically, emotionally, psychologically, socially, and that is why this kind of experience is having a very, very bad effect on the life of the dignity of these young girls, because they lose all sense of who they are.
When it comes to the East Europeans who are not, shall we say, the victims of these voodoo, how often do they pluck up the courage or manage to escape from their traffickers?
They have the courage to escape because, especially at the beginning, they were really also mistreated terribly by their pimps. Nowadays, it is a bit more difficult because the pimps have understood that just mistreating them, they were not going very far. So they use a new system. That's why this is a phenomenon that is always on the change. Nowadays, they make a kind of a contract with them, saying, now, if you work for me, I protect you on the streets. I'll give you accommodation. I'll give you everything you need. At the end of the month, I give you a salary. But all the rest of the money will be with me. So they are doing this kind of a trick in order to make the girls not to run away, because they can always say she has agreed. And at the end of the month, I give a salary. Or they do in another way. They pay on a percentage. If you get 100 euro, now you keep 10% and they get 90%. So these kind of things nowadays is becoming very common, and it is becoming more difficult for the girls to have the courage to run away. So there is a lot of work that needs to be done in contacting the girls. That's why we meet them on the streets. We meet, we establish a relationship, we know them, we know their stories, they are suffering. We are ready to help them because we have shelters. where we can welcome them, we can offer them the opportunity of rebuild again their life, whatever they have been stolen, their dignity, their identity, their youth, their health, because some of them get also very sick. Some of them become pregnant, and so they are forced to go for abortions. We have, for instance, young girls from Eastern Europe that you can count between 3, 4, 5 abortions each, and at the end they are all broken, they are all destroyed.
Let's talk a little bit about the clients. Presumably there's no lack of clients for these women who work on the streets, is that right?
Yes. We would not have such a big number of young women, because this is the point. This is a very sad point that unfortunately nobody wants to talk about it. When we speak about this forced prostitution, slavery, trafficking in human beings, we are always focusing our attention on women, especially young women, minors, and it is very seldom that we have the courage to speak about the demand, the consumers. That's why there is a great fight. We really have to fight against this corruption, this organization, and also we have to inform the mentality of our young people to start with, so that they can understand that a body of a young girl cannot be bought. Because they simply said, but I pay, so now she does what they want because I give her payment.
So these men, they come from all walks of life. How often are they married?
Now these men, 70% of them have wives, children, or they live with somebody. And that is very sad when we see cars on the street stopping, picking up these young girls. And at times we can see that there is a sign on the car saying, baby on board, or a babysitter.
Finally, any particular remark made by any of these girls that you've rescued or rehabilitated that really sums up either what they've been through or how they've recovered?
One of the greatest remarks, and the many of the remarks we receive from the girls, it is this: you have saved my life. I was destroyed. I was a dead body walking around, because how many times I wanted to get rid of my life because of the humiliation. It is wonderful to see how really working together we can achieve a great deal, and we can give hope for these young people that it is not the end, but it can be the beginning.
I was speaking there to Italian sister Eugenio Bonetti, a campaigner against forced prostitution. Helping the families of murder victims, and also the criminal who's facing the death penalty. Those are the twin activities of the Cherished Life Circle, a group in the US founded by the Sisters of Mercy to advocate for the abolition of capital punishment. The circle's primary goal is to campaign for the abolition of the death penalty through civil discourse and programs that uphold the sacredness of all life. One of its key activities is the annual holding of an ecumenical candlelight prayer service for the families of murder victims. Other activities include corresponding with people awaiting execution on death row, and also sometimes acting as a spiritual advisor to one or more of those prisoners. The Cherished Life Circle believes that no matter how horrendous the crime convicted, the perpetrator is a human being capable of repentance and turning over a new leaf. The circle was founded in 1993 by Camille D'Arienzo, a Sister of Mercy based in New York City, together with other religious sisters from the order. She told me more about their aims and activities.
I formed the Cherished Life Circle in 1993 when Governor Mario Cuomo, who was in ardent advocate of the abolition of the death penalty, was going out of office, and the then Governor P. Pataki was coming into office hoping to restore the death penalty to New York State. We did not have it at that time in our state. I had in my circle of friends, religious, lay, and priests, people who have come together to discuss the significant issues of our times, war and peace, poverty. And when we looked at this, we said, what are we going to do to enter this dialogue? So we came together as we do, who pray, who speak, who write, who have educational platforms, and we began to promote that.
Now, I know that one of the things you do is organize an annual candlelit ecumenical service for people who have suffered the loss of their loved ones through murder. Can you tell us very briefly something about that?
Yes, I will tell you first, though, as a founder of the Cherish Life Circle, through circumstances not of my choosing, but now of my great appreciation, I am a spiritual advisor to a man on death row in Terre Haute, Indiana, David Paul Hammer. So I know very well the suffering of those who are awaiting execution. Some years ago, we began to reach out to those relatives and friends of people who had been murdered. And every year at our Convent of Mercy in Brooklyn, we have a service which invites people who have so suffered. It is not a Catholic service because most of the people who come to us in the New York area are people of color, many from the Protestant tradition.
It must be a very emotional and moving thing. I mean, presumably a lot of people must choke up, you know, at this service. What's it like?
Yes, we had a woman come as an observer for the first time. Now, she didn't have anyone die in her own family, but she was looking to plan a similar service in her parish. And I watched this woman, Dr. Clara Garrett, sitting there listening to the stories of these heartbroken people, and tears just wet her face. One of the surprising things about these services, only once have we had anyone call for the death penalty for the person who murdered his son. Now, I think that's extraordinary. It is much more common for us to see these wounded, faith-filled people say, I don't want another mother to suffer the pain I have endured. So they want punishment, but not execution.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you are spiritual advisor to a man on death row called David Hammer. Can you briefly sketch for us the reason that he ended up on death row and how long he's been there?
David Paul Hammer is 49 years old, and he has been continually incarcerated since he was 19. He grew up in poverty in the state of Oklahoma with parents who were migrant workers and a mother who was abusive. They moved around a great deal so that his education was never complete. It was a different school every few months. By the time he was 16 and the victim of psychological, physical, sexual abuse, he ran away, got into drugs, married at 16, fathered a child, and at 19, was involved in armed robbery. He had been before the judge a number of times, and in, I guess, exasperation, the judge then sentenced him to 1,200 years, no possibility of parole. Now, at 19, when he heard the doors slam behind him, he had no reason to accommodate the system, whereas no social system had served him well. So he continued to do, you know, negative things in prison, and in 1996, he murdered a cellmate, for which he got the death penalty. But in the meantime, he underwent a conversion and has become, well, they call him at Terre Haute the unofficial chaplain. He is so good with the other inmates. He's brilliant, and he's a paralegal. He takes care of their appeals. He looks out for their special needs. No one on death row has money, and most of them are there because of poor counsel. He helps them in 100 ways. He also designs Christmas cards, which we sell every year. And we have probably contributed over $50,000 or $60,000 to help children in need. David was confirmed a Catholic, brought into the faith in his cell in Terre Haute, Indiana, in October of 2000.
Now, you said he had a very abusive childhood, particularly his mother. There was one incident there that you told me about earlier that involved a puppy, right?
Mm-hmm. When David was about 10 years old, he had a younger brother, slightly retarded, and a still younger sister, probably about 6 years old. Someone took compassion on these really poor children, hungry, very often hungry children, not cared for. and clearly being abused, and they gave the family a puppy. Now, anyone who has ever owned a dog knows how quickly the bonding occurs. And so it was that in the course of the day, the three children played with the dog, they owned it, they loved it, and when the mother came home, she went into one of her irrational fits. She sent David up to the house, the shack, to get a burlap bag, and she sent the two younger children away. Then she forced David to watch her while she clubbed the puppy to death. He screamed in protest, screamed and cried, and to no avail. And when the puppy was dead, she forced David to drag the burlap bag to the nearby pond and throw it in. It was kind of interesting that the last day that David was supposed to be executed, his execution date was set, but that night he called a friend in Indianapolis, and he said, "I want you to do me a favor. I want you to go to the dog pound, and I want you to rescue a dog that is slated to be executed, slated for death, an unwanted animal." He said, "I can't save another human being, but perhaps I can save a dog." And so the woman he called went, and she got the dog, and David calls that his dog, which was trained to visit elderly people in the nursing homes. And so that dog lives because David lives. But I'm sure there's a connection with that childhood memory.
Okay, coming back to the families of murder victims, have you got any feedback from those who you have helped or any other poignant anecdotes to share with us?
Oh, there are so many. One of the first services, it might have been the very first one we had, we pre-register everybody. We make out signs that bear the names of the murdered person, and the family member representing the murdered person wears that sign in the chapel during the service. Well, just as the service was about to begin, I could hear someone running up the steps. And there was a young boy, all dressed in suit and tie and brown shoes. It's a small African-American child. And I said, "Honey, what are you doing here?" And he said, "My mama sent me." I said, "But do you know what this is?" And he said, "Yes, my mama only heard today that it's for people who were murdered. My brother was murdered." "How old was he?" "He was 15. My mama's sick, she couldn't come, so she sent me." "How did you get here?" "I took two trains." The boy was 10 years old. So, you know, we quickly made a sign and added his brother's name to the list, and we seated him with some of the mothers in the chapel. And when his brother's name was called and he stood to go to the center aisle, to go into the sanctuary with his lighted candle, which was part of the ritual, he burst out crying. His little shoulders shook, and mothers surrounded him and brought him up, you know, to the sanctuary. And it was a very moving moment. And then when the service was over, I looked for that child. I needed more information about him. But he was gone. He wasn't where the refreshments were. He wasn't out on the street. But that boy in the brown shoes remains in my mind almost 10 years now as kind of the angel that alerts us to the fact that children should not see that violence has the last word, and that faith can help individuals to overcome the worst hardships, and that there is a community of support.
So you never found out where he came from or anything more?
No,
about him?
Nothing.
I was speaking there to Camille D'Arienzo, a Sister of Mercy from New York City.
That's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.